How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Dineen. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health, usually through interviews with genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, patient advocates, and more. I have a panel of guests joining me on this episode to discuss the Camden Opioid Research Initiative. Three scientists from the project join me, including Dr. Stefan Sajic, the scientific lead on the project, Dr. Caitlin Baston, the director of addiction medicine at Cooper University Healthcare, and Dr. Russ Buono, a professor of biomedical sciences at Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. Before we launch into the interview, I have a big favor to ask from all of you. The podcast award nomination season has begun, and it's a people's choice type of award. So in order to be in the running, I need listeners like you to nominate the show. In 2015 and 16, DNA Today was nominated, so it'd be such an honor to be nominated again and be in the running to see if I can win. In order to be in the running, though, I need 2 minutes of your time. It's really simple. Just go to podcastawards.com and enter DNA Today for the science and medicine category. That's it, I promise. Fast and easy. Podcastawards.com. Nominate DNA Today for the science and medicine category. Now, this closes on July 31st, 2019, but don't forget about it if you're listening to this live or early in July. If you can please pause the podcast and go nominate the show while you're thinking of it. If you enjoy listening, it really helps to increase the visibility so other people can also benefit from learning through the show. Again, very easy. I'll say it one last time. Podcastawards.com. Enter DNA Today for the science and medicine category. I'll also include this information in the show notes that pops up on your phone and blog post that goes with this episode on the website, dnapodcast.com. Thanks again in advance. I really appreciate the support for the show. Thank you so much, guys, for coming on the show and sharing your experience and the research that you're doing. I'm really looking forward to hearing about this.
Hello. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So the opioid epidemic has had a major impact in the U.S. for those that may not be aware, among other countries. In 2017, more than 47,000 Americans died of an opiate overdose. And currently, every day in the U.S., 130 people die from opioid overdoses. And when I heard you guys were doing this research, I was really intrigued to learn more about the role genetics plays in this drug addiction. And so that's what we're going to be really talking about on today's episode. But to start us off, what are you guys targeting in your research specifically, and what do you guys hope to learn from it?
This is Stefan. So I'm a scientist at Coriell Institute. Maybe I'll just start by giving a little bit of an overview of the project. So our project is called the Camden Opioid Research Initiative. It's a collaboration between three institutions. So the Coriell Institute, Cooper University Healthcare, and the Cooper Medical School at Rowan University. And just in short, you know, the idea behind this project is to study the spectrum of opioid use. So all the way from patients who are receiving an opioid in for pain relief, that would be something that's very common that many people experience, to a problematic condition where people have actually developed an addiction or a use disorder, all the way to the most severe outcome you can imagine, which is an overdose death. So what we wanted to do is study people along the full spectrum, of use, of opioid use. And in terms of what do we want to do, overall we're trying to identify risk factors. So risk factors at each stage there. So, you know, for people who are receiving opioid medications, which ones are at risk of developing use problems and which aren't? Can doctors use that information to tailor treatment? For those people who have developed use problems and are receiving treatment, can we tell from their genetics which medications might work better for them? And, you know, are there any genetic factors that predispose certain people to be at greater risk for overdose? So yeah, that's like it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's a great overview of the research that we're doing. This is Dr. Caitlin Baston. I'm a physician, an addiction medicine specialist at Cooper University Healthcare. And I'll just say that I'm really hopeful to learn a lot from this research throughout the process. And mainly, you know, as a physician, my number one priority is my patient health and safety. And what I'm hoping to learn is more information that I can counsel my patients better, so I can talk to them more about risks and benefits of medications. I can talk to them more about what medications might be more beneficial for them if they already have a use disorder. How do I treat my patients the best? How do I look at every unique individual and treat them just as that and make sure that they're getting the best care that they can? And of course, how do I talk to patients about what their risks are in their lifetime? And how do we help people avoid the dangerous situations that might result in, like Stefan said, the end stage use disorder or overdose and death? So I'm really hopeful, as I am with this illness, because there is good treatment for it, that we can take that to the next level and really learn even more to target best care for our patients.
Yes, this is Russ Bono. I'm a professor of neuroscience and genetics at the Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, and could just put a big ditto to what my two colleagues just said. And of course, there's lots of evidence out there from family and adoption and twin studies that suggest that there are genetics that play a serious role in drug addiction. But of course, any good geneticist would say that it's not just genetics, it's environment as well. And we're trying to capture both the genetic signatures as well as some of the biopsychosocial issues that affect these individuals.
And it really is such an epidemic that's happening that needs to be addressed. And I'm very happy that you're doing this research and that you're taking that patient-first approach to look at how we can solve this. One of the aspects you're talking about is genetics playing a role. And part of your research is doing genetic testing. What type of genetic testing are you doing? Are there specific genes you're targeting and looking at?
Sure. So I can speak to that one. You know, when we were beginning this project, we did a pretty thorough review of the literature on the potential genetic determinants of opioid use problems. We're focused really on three different areas. So one would be drug metabolism. So certainly it's well known that people's bodies process drugs, including opioid medications, differently. For opioid medications, the enzyme that's most important is called CYP2D6, and it's pretty well established. There are clinical guidelines out there for drugs like tramadol and codeine and oxycodone that these drugs should be administered at different doses for different individuals, and that you know, genetics can affect efficacy and side effects. It's also quite, I think, reasonable to think that genetics could also influence people's potential for developing use problems. So if someone has a you know, metabolic variation that makes it unpleasant for them to take a drug, they're probably less likely to develop a problem. If they have a metabolic variation that makes it more pleasant for them to take a drug, they might be more at risk. So drug metabolism is one category. There's also been a lot of research about variation in the actual opioid receptors. So these are the things, the proteins on neurons that the opioids bind to. They're part of the endogenous opioid signaling system in the brain. And there's been a lot of research about whether variation in those can influence susceptibility to developing use problems. And then finally, there's been a lot of research in reward pathways in the brain. So essentially, speaking generally, the dopamine system and some of the related reward systems. So we're really interested in looking at genes in those systems. In terms of the technologies that we're using, we're going to be collecting, going to be doing whole exome sequencing on everyone. So the exome, for those not familiar with it, is the maybe 1-2% of the genome that actually codes proteins, as opposed to the other 98%, which is non-coding. We are also including a genotyping panel that captures some of the important genetic variants that are outside of the exome.
So you're really taking a look at certain genes and paying extra close attention to that, but at the same time, you're doing whole exome sequencing, which is becoming more standard in genetic research and looking at, you said it's only 1-2% of the genome, but that's the active part that is actually coding for proteins that we end up producing in our bodies.
Right.
And so, yeah.
And it's still all 30,000 or so genes in the human genome, so that even though we're most interested in the areas that I mentioned, there's a substantial opportunity for discovery there too, novel variation and the way that it could impact disease risk.
Yeah, you could end up finding a gene that you didn't think would be related to it, but seeing that maybe there's variations in those that are have overdosed from opioids or have become addicted or things like that. We've talked about the genetics behind this, but there's also things that aren't entirely genetic, as we kind of hinted at before. Can you speak about some of the other factors that are taken into account?
Sure. I can talk a little bit about that as I run our addiction treatment program at Cooper. One of the things that we know, we're learning more and more about now is epigenetics, or kind of even how environment and exposures that we have in our lives can even change the way our genes are expressed, change our hormonal patterns in our body. So we know now that we talk about nature versus nurture, genes versus environment, and we know that this is actually pretty deeply interplayed and that some of this can even be inherited. We can inherit trauma from generations before us. So we're learning more and more about this, and we know that trauma and other things that happen in our lives can put us at risk for all sorts of health problems, everywhere from diabetes and obesity to use disorders or addictions. So we're really looking at, in our patients, especially in one of the studies, so our patients with active use disorder, doing pretty extensive psychosocial assessments to learn about what mental health risk factors, what trauma and social risk factors these patients have, and how that's affecting maybe their development of a use disorder or even their treatment of a use disorder, so that we can appropriately target that and, again, counsel patients and treat them the absolute best that we can.
And you're looking at it from a bigger picture of not just taking samples and looking at the genetics, but also looking at the people behind that and seeing how this may be playing a role in their lives and really impacting them. Part of your initiative is creating this new biobank, so bio samples that are available for other addiction researchers. And what was interesting that I was learning is that you're including brain tissue in that. So we've been talking, I would think if you're doing genetic testing, maybe you're using blood, but you're also looking at brain tissue. Why is it important to be focused on the brain tissue?
Well, as you would imagine, we are deep believers that addiction is a disease of the brain, that the brain is being influenced to make these choices or decisions. And we're very interested in looking at the molecules within the brain tissue itself. So obviously, the reward pathways in the brain, as Stefan had mentioned, the dopaminergic pathways. And we're very interested in actually sequencing the whole genome from the brain tissue to compare back to the exome data that will be generated from the blood of the same individual. And we think this is a viable way to go. Also, of course, it's not just about the DNA molecules, it's the RNA molecules and the proteins themselves. And having the actual brain structures banked and available for the research community means that people who are smarter than us with different ideas will be able to access these tissues and look at the molecules that they have discovered or are interested in linking to substance abuse disorder.
So one thing you mentioned there was that you're looking at whole exome sequencing, but then comparing that to differences you might find in the brain. So genetic variants can exist in the brain that aren't necessarily in other areas of the body. How does that work?
So there's a field out there known as somatic cell mutation. And this has really started to take off in the cancer world, where people were sequencing the DNA of tumors and comparing them back to the blood of the individual who was affected, and able to then track down the various mutations that arise in neoplastic tissue, cancerous tissue. And so what we've learned from that is that if, in fact, you go into someone's body and you derive DNA from different sources, different organs within the body, in fact, you may find that the DNA is not the same in all of the cells in the body. And there is evidence for mutations that happen early in development in a cell that then gives rise to daughter cells who all carry the mutation, leading to a sort of mosaic or chimeric pattern. And this can happen in any organ or any tissue during development. And there's some evidence out there in aging and in the epilepsy world that suggests this is happening in the brain of individuals as well. So we're very interested in trying to identify if there are mutations in the DNA that are happening in the brain tissue that you wouldn't necessarily have seen if you only sequenced the DNA from a blood sample.
And specifically if those are playing a role in addiction and what you're looking at, but you could end up finding something that's not related as science goes.
Of course.
Now, when you're studying these brain tissues, we're looking at the genetics, but you're also looking at the chemical differences between like those who died from opioid overdoses and say family members that were not addicted. You're looking at the differences there?
For the differences, we'll be mostly studying control tissues that are derived either post-mortem or from the operating room from brain tissue of individuals who don't have substance abuse disorders.
Yeah, I can weigh in a little bit on the inclusion of family members, though. So I think it's worth noting, you know, two of our scientific inspirations when we were designing this study, one of them was a project called the Utah Suicide Genetics Project, which took a similar approach to a very similar, a similarly serious problem. So clearly there you have a very severe phenotype would be one way to put it, which is completed suicide. And so the idea that the researchers in Utah did was to collect genetic samples from both the individual who completed suicide and also their family members. And they were able to come up with some really interesting genetic findings. Another one that's maybe a bit more well known in sort of the popular media is the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which has been studied in football players. So again, similar idea, different method. The similar idea is to collect all of the cases and, you know, analyze them for contributing factors. So the family members are, to go back to the original question, the family members are really included in this study to help us understand, the influence of, inherited genetic factors on suicide risk. I hope that gets to it.
Yeah, having the family samples is super important as well if you're looking for somatic cell mutations. Imagine if I have first-degree relative DNA of the individual who passed from opioid abuse. I could tell whether or not they've inherited those mutations or they happened de novo in them spontaneously.
And so with your research, how do you see it impacting treatment? We have a transition of healthcare going into precision medicine and having people have their treatments very individualized to their genetics or drug metabolism or other aspects of them as an individual. Are you seeing your research kind of having a role in this future precision medicine approach?
Yeah, I'll take a shot at it from the research side and then maybe Caitlin can speak to it from the clinical side. That's definitely the end goal. That's the future that we're trying to build towards. I'd say in this space, it's somewhat early days. We are including a component in our study of chronic pain patients where in a sub-study, we will be, for some participants, returning results to their doctors about the opioid medications that I mentioned, the ones for which there are current clinical guidelines, tramadol, codeine, and oxycodone. But those don't really go to addiction risk. Those are, again, just informing the doctor of potential differences in efficacy or side effect profiles. I think one of the goals of this study is really to help build the evidence base for future implementation of, precision medicine in the addiction space. One of the things that I think is somewhat unique about this study is that it has a relatively diverse population compared to most of the work that's been done. You may be aware that unfortunately, there are definite disparities in terms of the populations that have been included in genetic research to date. It's been overwhelmingly people of European ancestry. And so this helps expand that. It also studies this genetic variation in our Camden population. So in the particular environmental setting that these individuals are living in.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I think that this study gives us a unique opportunity to look at both in genetics and environmental factors, to look at potentially epigenetics, to really learn a lot from the biopsychosocial picture of medicine. And as a family physician, I will say that I look at that whole picture when I'm treating a patient. We need both individual information to counsel our patients. We need you know, whole picture biopsychosocial information, not just from the bio part or the genetics part, but their entire living situation, their social factors, and then mental, emotional factors as well. And we also need population data. So this is one piece of medicine that's really important. It'll help us react better on an individual basis. And we can also hopefully start to see trends that can help us make decisions for, you know, population and kind of general overall health of our society.
Really being able to support patients and giving them medications that are going to help them in the long run and not set them up for addiction and failure, and that being really a core concept from what it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. We want to just empower patients to make the best decisions for themselves and give the providers the information that they need to have those vital conversations with patients so the shared decision making can lead to the best outcomes.
And I was reading about companies that are starting to sell risk scores to doctors that explain if their patients at an elevated risk to become addicted to opioids. Do you see this becoming more mainstream and a solution to the opioid epidemic? Or do you see it bringing on bigger issues of people not being able to get medications they need because of this? Or, you know, is there other similar drugs that are less addictive that are a better solution? What are we looking at for the future?
So, with all information that we get in medicine, with everything that science gives us, we have to be able to treat the person that's in front of us. And I will say the one thing that we've seen happen as this epidemic has, you know, continued to have a lot of press and information is that sometimes we don't react to the person in front of us the way that we should. It is so important. It's vital information to know the risk that your patient is under, to be able to have that conversation with your patient. It's also vitally important that we continue to treat every single patient. So if somebody's at high risk and they have pain, we have to treat them appropriately. And that means that we have to have wonderful options. We don't always have the best things in front of us in that moment, but it doesn't mean, you know, cutting a patient off, stopping a certain treatment, refusing to treat a patient because of their risk. It should be the opposite. We should know that risk. We should treat that patient appropriately. We should get that patient the absolute best standard of care. You know, we have medications to treat use disorder. We have medications to treat pain. And, you know, we should all be empathetic providers when it comes to this. So I think that it has great information for providers, and we just have to make sure we're supporting providers the best we can so that they utilize that information to help their patients and it doesn't go the other way.
And it sounds like we really need to do a better job, you know, as a country and in the healthcare field of educating doctors of what the options are, that not necessarily maybe prescribing someone certain dosage of opiates or whatever, that maybe a different medication is better, or if they are addicted, to help them wean off. And from other conversations I've had, it sounds like some doctors are not being educated about this or taking the initiative. You certainly are.
There's a really big push right now in medical education to start early and to continue that education so that we're doing a better job of teaching not only alternative pain regimens, but also how to treat opioid use disorder. So we have excellent medications to treat opioid use disorder. We have three of them. This is not an epidemic that has arisen like some in our past without the science or treatment behind it. We are, of course, learning more and more and coming up with better and better treatments, but it is imperative that physicians and other providers understand the medications that we have, use them appropriately. There's pharmacotherapy for opioid use disorder, and it's underutilized in our country right now. We know that outcomes are absolutely better when people are given those pharmacotherapy options and when they're utilized. So it's important that we teach people that and that they're not afraid to use the treatment and therapy that we have. So it's really key as we're getting this information that we, number one, physicians and providers learn more and more that in head-to-head trials, non-opioid therapy for acute pain can be as effective, if not more effective, than opioid therapy, that we're using alternatives. Number two, if somebody has opioid dependence and tolerance, with chronic pain, that we treat that appropriately, that we know what to do for those patients, and that we have alternative medications if they need it, and that we don't cut people off or not help them on the other end. And number three, that if somebody has a use disorder, a full use disorder, that we use the pharmacotherapy that we have and offer our standard of care to our patients so that they have the best chance at the best outcome and a much lower rate of overdose and death.
And it's so important to be able to follow patients, as what you're saying is, no matter where they are in the process, or really being able to look at, okay, how can I help this person achieve what they need to and go through pain management effectively?
That's right. All of our patients deserve to live full, satisfying lives, and that's everybody on the spectrum. And it's our job to do the best we can to set them up for success.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cautionary tale, right? We're so focused on trying to reduce the opioid epidemic that we certainly don't want to deny opioids to people who really need them. And, you know, this notion that folks may be drug seeking as opposed to actually needing the drugs. So there, we don't want to see people who get caught in the middle there, folks who need these meds and are somehow being denied them. So it's a tough job for our physician colleagues to walk that line.
And a question I wanted to ask before we end the show is, with the samples that you're accepting into the biobank, are you doing extensive toxicology screening to see what drugs were present at the time of death? There are different opioids, different drugs within that class. What does this information tell you that could potentially help public health officials in the short term? Because it is an epidemic that needs to be addressed now.
Yeah, so that's, I'll take that one. That's a very interesting a question. So I guess I first just want to note that, you know, I want to give our staff who are doing this a lot of credit, because they're actually doing a very difficult thing, which is reaching out to families immediately after they've lost someone and asking them to participate in a research study, which is a hard thing to ask. They definitely have undergone training, sensitivity training, working with grieving families so that they're able to do that in a thoughtful way. But one thing that I think helps in that conversation is to be able to truthfully say that there's a potential for this donation to the biobank to inform research not just on a time frame of 5 or 10 or 20 years, but on the very short term. So we are doing extensive toxicology screening on the blood samples that we get from donations to the overdose biobank. It's far, far more comprehensive than what's typically done by a medical examiner. A typical medical examiner might do 60, it might look for 60 or 100 compounds. We're looking at 900. And you may be well aware that the drug supply in the United States has recently been, there's a lot of new stuff in there. Many people have heard of fentanyl, but there are a lot of fentanyl derivatives out there that are appearing quickly and somewhat unexpectedly. So actually having that information is very valuable for the medical examiner. In some cases, it might be able to help them better understand what contributed to that particular individual's death. It also might be able to allow us to, you know, to provide some early warning to public health officials about what's out there on the street. You know, you can think of this in terms of bad batches, or it might just be what's intended to be out there, but it might be something new. So, you know, that is, I think, a unique feature of the study. I'll just mention from the scientific standpoint, if we want to look at the influence of, you know, differences in drug metabolism on why someone overdosed, we've got to know what was in their body. And so that, you know, that's just an essential research piece as well.
And with fentanyl's potency just being so incredibly high, I feel like that's something that scares a lot of people, and, you know, of different police officers that are coming on the scene to someone that is overdosing, and even touching them, that they can, if they've touched the drug, that they can start having a strong reaction. So this is something that is very severe. And so it's interesting to see that you are looking at this and looking at the types, and, you know, mentioning fentanyl, I think, is probably one of the major ones you're looking at.
Well, it is. So we're looking at fentanyl because it's you know, from if you look at sort of the epidemiological data, it's pervasive in the heroin supply right now. I would just put a note of caution in interpreting some of those stories about first responder exposure. I think it's definitely very valuable for, you know, for police and fire and EMS to know what's in the drug supply so they know what they're getting into. But I think some of the stories about, you know, having intoxication due to touching fentanyl and things like that, perhaps should be viewed a little bit skeptically. You know, people don't take these drugs by rubbing them on their body, right? They take them by injecting them. And so it's in many cases, it might not be possible to get, you know, meaningful levels of drug into the system through some of those routes. But we do think it's really important to characterize what's in the drug supply.
Thanks for the clarification, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Stefan, Caitlin, and Russ, for coming on the show and sharing your research. I'm very interested to see what kind of conclusions you're able to come to this and just building this biobank so that other researchers of addiction can use this. It sounds like you're making a major impact, and I'm excited to see where this information goes.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, you're welcome, and thank you.
To learn more about the Camden Opioid Research Initiative, head over to corinj.org. Just a reminder that if you enjoyed this show, please nominate it in the podcast awards. As I said at the top of the episode, in order to be in the running, I need listeners like you to nominate the show. Only takes 2 minutes or less. Just go to podcastawards.com and enter DNA Today for the Science and Medicine category. Again, this closes on July 31st, 2019. Don't forget, though, do it right now if you can. One last time, that's podcastawards.com. Nominate DNA Today for the Science and Medicine category. I so appreciate it. If you're looking for more information on the show, any episode we've had over 100, go to dnapodcast.com. I'm also on social media. Recently did a giveaway of the last guest's recent book from Brian Kirkpatrick. So did a giveaway on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook. Also had a recent post about Pride Month last month. So all kinds of great content on social media. On Twitter, I'm at DNA Podcast. Instagram, a little different, at DNA Radio. And if you have any questions for me about genetics, any questions for the guests I've had on today, other guests, email in at info@dnapodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.